hardest thing to figure out.
Plato and Aristotle divide the world between them. Okay. Alfred North Whitehead, an English philosopher at the beginning of the century, said that all of history, all of philosophy is a series of footnotes to Plato. And what you need to take away from this, very short, in a survey course like this, is that Plato talks about the spiritual world, and Aristotle talks about what you might call the real world or the world of nature. Right? Aristotle went down to the seashore and counted shells. Right? He looked at the mountains, he looked at the rocks, he looked at your bones. Plato really was much more about the human mind, right? And how we perceive the world and what it is we're perceiving. Okay? If you start thinking about it, you know, you don't really know that there's anything out there. Right? I don't want to get too complicated because I'm not a philosopher, right? But people, we're kind of mystical people. People read horoscopes. I mean, you know, Aristotle would say, well, let's look at the evidence for whether these horoscopes work. And the evidence is zero. They don't work. But everybody believes them anyway because, see, everybody's got this, or a lot of people believe them anyway. People have dreams and hopes and fears, and we kind of live in a world of shadows and mysticisms and desires, and we can't figure things out. Even when we have things figured out, we don't know what's going on. And the big thing we don't know about is, of course, the supernatural, or God, right? Or as Plato would have called him, the good, right? What is out there? And Plato was constantly thinking about this. How in this world, limited here, stuck inside these bodies we're given, which seem to be interfering with our perceptions. I mean, some people can hear, right? But some people can't. So, you know? So some people can, okay? So your body's getting in the way. And just as you can experience more or less of the world around you, there seems to be, according to most people, Aristotle would say nonsense, but according to most people, there seems to be something else going on out there. This supernatural world. Now, how can you know about it? We don't have eyes to see God. We don't have ears, right? What we get, according to the kind of Plato view of things, is occasional glimpses. Little things happen. Some people say, well, here's a miracle. Rational thought can't explain this thing. Right? So Plato's a big believer that there's another world out there, that this world of, you know, limited physicality is just that. It's just a place we're stuck. This, of course, a very powerful idea because Christianity picked up, you know, just took Plato right over, okay, and said, well, this thing that you've been trying to figure out is actually God, you know, Jesus, stuff like that, and other religions take it over, okay? Well, Plato, he can't prove that the other world exists, all right? He's not really going into that, although a lot of the dialogues of Socrates are to prove that the good exists, right? And Socrates tends to argue against guys who say, look, there's no such thing as good, there's only strength. I'm right, I'm stronger than she is, therefore, whack. What I want's good, what she wants is irrelevant. Okay? And Socrates has to say, well, are you sure that strength is the essence of the good? Okay? And he does this paradoxical argument. Even if you're a tyrant, he proves, you still want people to be good. Which is, it's a very hard argument to follow, but if we push it to the extreme, all right, I think that, I've been trying to put this into easy words for a long time, and if you take even the devil himself, if you believe in the devil, right, he assumes he wants bad stuff, right? He wants everything to be messed up. So anything bad is therefore good. Ta-da, you've just proved the existence of the good. Okay, even if you have the devil, because And if he actually wanted everybody to mess things up, then all his followers would be messing him up and they would all believe in God. Okay? You see, just to spite him because that's what he likes. So you have a morality that's sort of built into things. That's Socrates' point. And the location of this morality somehow depends on the afterlife. This is an extrapolation of this idea that if you're going to die, there must be some kind of good. Now, the one thing I wanted, what's interesting here in this selection is he gives three proofs of this good, starting on page 817. And for the life of me, I cannot even at this stage of my life understand the first two proofs. All right? Try as I might. Somebody wants to explain them to me, they're just good, because the stuff about the sun and the divided line is tough. The sun, I think, is just a metaphor for the good. We associate the light with the good and things like that. What's going on with the line, I don't know. But the third proof is the cave, and this is the thing I want you to know. Okay? From Plato's Republic, the allegory of the cave. Right? Well, in Plato's world, the problem with this world is it's a mere shadow of the world out there. Call it heaven, call it the supernatural. So this is what we, you've heard people talk about being something's platonic. Well, this is it, right? Let's take something simple like a triangle. You can have a triangle in this world, right? But it's not a great triangle, it's just a triangle. But somewhere out there is a world of perfect forms, right? There's this idea of a triangle. There's an idea of a table. The table you have, you can tell it's pretty crummy. But, you can get an idea of one, and you can sort of try and make it better. If you keep making the triangle better, making the table better, or making yourself better, eventually you'll get to this ideal. These are the idols or the eidolons, or what ideas he calls them, however you translate the Greek. Out there, there's a world of forms. And what we have in the world are imperfect replicas. So the world is an imperfect place. This is not very Aristotelian. Aristotle just, table, it's got four legs. Great. Love it. It's as far as he wants to go. Okay. But Plato's going, I don't know. Now the consequences of this imperfection for Plato are that art is very imperfect. Because art is imitation of something else. I paint a picture of you, it's an imitation of you. Well, somewhere out there, there's a perfect you. That Mona Lisa in heaven or whatever. Right? You are this imperfect thing. And when I do a painting or I do any kind of artistic representation, I write a novel, I do a play, I do a statue, that's itself an imperfect representation of an imperfect representation. So art is twice removed from reality. Right? This is why Plato banished poets from his ideal republic. Okay, but Plato was a bit of a fascist. You want to be careful with the guy, right? And a mystic. And we don't want to follow these guys too far. But it's hard to disprove them. Yeah. Excuse me. Oh, modern art. That's a good question. Yeah, sure. Well, that avoids the problem of representation, doesn't it? See, that's a good question. You think a painting's supposed to create a certain emotion, a certain feeling of joy or sadness? Let's say I do my modern art. I take my bucket of paint. I throw it on the canvas. I'm not sure it's emotion. It may be emotion, which is a fascinating question. But if you listen to artists talk, what they're really talking about is the way the paint adheres to the surface, the way it distorts the light. Okay? They're really almost talking in mystical terms. You could. So I think your point is really good. Modern art is probably extremely platonic. It's all about spirituality. And if there's an emotion, it's this joy, this pleasure. Oh my God, do you see those paint drops? And it's even better if I jump on it myself, you know, right? Because I can feel my own emotion. I don't know. And modern artists are very sensitive to color, and color is, well, if you take this first dialogue on the sun, light is always your reflection of your spirituality. So, you know, take a Matisse, the figures are really silly, but the colors are what people talk about. Yeah. Question? Yeah. Yeah, the feeling you get from meditating on it is the happiness. I don't think you can put happiness in. Okay. You can make your statue of love, L-O, sideways O-V-E, you know. And it's supposed to give you sort of warm and cuddly feeling. Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, that's a really good point. Certainly, at the brilliant terms of modern art, I mean, it's against representation. Because from a Platonic standpoint, there's nowhere to go with representation. It's a loser, theoretically, twice removed from reality. So let's get rid of representation. Let's go for this emotional thing. So modern art, you could say, is a Platonic art form. Aristotle looks at it and says, well, paint coheres at a factor of mu minus 10 over divided by, you know, sigma taken from 1 to 9 or something. I don't know. Some equation, right? Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty good point. So what's the allegory of the cave? Oh, you got it? Go ahead. Yeah, but not. Give me whatever you got. Both. I'll take both. The question, it's an allegory of how you know about the spiritual world and why it's so difficult. And the bottom line is, if anybody comes back and says, I've been to Hovey Hall and I saw God. All right? And you say, did you? I'm you know, I don't believe you. It's true. I really saw. Yeah, really, I did. How do you know? How do you know? Anybody who makes a claim is always going to sound mad. Right? And that's all Plato is saying this. For all we know, he did see God. But we don't believe him. Okay? Because we have no way of talking about that spiritual world. That's the problem of being locked in this real world. Right? So the allegory of the cave, what it says, it does an experiment in the real world to show the limit. Even in this, we can imagine a situation in this real world where our vision is limited, and it's just like that with our relation to the spiritual world. And that's the point of sitting in the cave. So imagine that you have a bunch of prisoners, and we're all lined up at this table, and there's a giant spotlight. I'm getting this a little backwards, but you get the idea. Casting our shadows up on that wall. And we're sitting here, and we don't know there's a light back there. And the only thing we can see is shadows on the wall. Right? So in other words, our whole perception is two-dimensional, black and white. Right? And that's all we know, because somehow we got these things on, so we're not seeing ourselves. Right? And somebody comes along and says, hey, you guys are actually sitting in a cave, and there's stuff behind you. And there's this giant light. So you're only seeing shadows. And there's this thing called red. You go, the guy's mad. Mad as a hatter. Might as well lock him up. Okay? That's the same thing as somebody coming back from the spiritual world, right? This is, frankly, impossible to argue against, okay? And we just have to, I think we just have to leave it at that, right? That, but it's something that haunts people. Right? It's difficult to, and the language Platonists tend to, well, use is they talk about the good and the glimpses. I think those are the two key words. That the equivalent of that light, actually out there in the spiritual world, is the big fat light, the big sun, the big all radiating good, okay, which is Plato's term for it, which if you're sitting there and you're like in the first century AD and you're reading the Hebrew Bible, you go, well, there's this guy God, you know, put them together. What do we get? We got a platonicized Hebraic system, and we call it Christianity, which for your purposes is Thursday. Okay. All right. That's about it. The Bible, I mean, the glimpses are so fascinating. And you go back to the Old Testament, and you suddenly realize, and we didn't read enough of it for you to really get this notion, but just even what you read, the times that God actually shows up are incredibly limited. Usually people are wrapping their forearms in deer skin or sheepskins and stuff like that, you know, or getting seduced by Potiphar's wife. But the actual God plays a very limited role in all those stories, right? He walks in the garden. He comes down thunderously at the end of Job and tells him, you know, what do you know about whales? Right? But it's pretty limited, right? Because you only get glimpses, and people say, hey, you know, this is just like Plato, right? So I think that's it's about the limits of my knowledge, is all you need to know for me about Plato. So there's this thing called the allegory of the cave, and the point of it is to show you the limits of your own perception and to convince you that there might be something out there that you don't know about, right? Now, the Aristotle is, I had a wonderful little slideshow for, but what I wanted you is just to have the section on the poetics. And here's what I want you to know. Now, another course is I spend like the entire semester on this stuff. But for this, Aristotle says what he's talking about in the poetics is how to make a poem. What do we need? And by poem, he means a made thing. The word poetic in Greek just means to shape or form. So a poem is anything that's shaped or formed. Out of words in this case, right? Literary art. So we're not talking about sculpture or dance, which are also imitative arts, but they're not made with words, right? So the poem is something made out of words. So, and of course he didn't know about film, but everything he says would apply to a film or any TV show. So this is actually pretty useful stuff. Okay. And he said, well, you know, what does the poet do as a poet that other artists don't do? Right. Now, somebody can teach you to talk, and he's a rhetorician. Teach you how to make a speech. And we notice people tend to speak a lot in movies and TV shows and plays and novels. I'm not sure the speaking, he says, is really the key. The thing that only the poet does, the maker of this thing. This like a drama, like the Agamemnon, with a beginning and a middle and an end. And what the poet really does is he creates the plot. Right? The homecoming of Ulysses. Right? The wrath of Achilles. Right? Here's the story of a man who gets angry at his boss, sits out the war, gets even angrier at the other side when they kill his best friend, rejoins the war, and, you know, goes home, or tries to go home. Okay, right? That's what poets do. They make a plot. Right? So that's the most important thing of a poet, is that overall shape of the story. any kind of story. Did I ever tell you the one about the farmer's daughter? I don't even know what that farmer's daughter is. Anybody know that story? Anyway. Fantasy. The second element, Aristotle says, is character. Oh yeah, the word for plot is mythos in Greek. So really, when you talk about the myth, you're just talking about the story in its basic sense. Like, by the end of today, I hope to get to Ovid's Metamorphoses, and we'll have the one myth I give you is that you read was Daphne and Apollo. Okay, here's the story of the time Apollo decided he, the time Apollo fell madly in love with Daphne, and she ran away and sought help from her father, a river, and he turned her into a tree. Okay, so Apollo couldn't rape her. And to this day, Daphne is the laurel tree, right? And that's a metamorphosis or a change. I'm going to tell you, she was a human being, now she's a tree, and that's how it happened. Okay? So I might as well tell you this story right now. See, one day Apollo was, this is a story, this is a mythos. Apollo was walking along and he saw a little kid sitting by the side of the road, and the kid had a bow and arrow. And Apollo says, "You are an awfully small kid to have a bow and arrow. Bow and arrows are for mighty warriors like me, Apollo, son of Zeus, god of the sun. I'm somebody. And by the way, I just killed the sacred python. That's how tough I am. You are just a little kid. Here, let me kick sand in your face." And the kid says, "I don't like this guy one bit, okay? But this is no ordinary little kid. This is the son of Venus. This is Cupid, we call him, the little god of love. And he's got, that bow and arrow's got two kinds of arrows. One's gold, and when you get shot with that, you fall instantly in love. And one set of arrows is made of lead. And when you get shot with the lead arrows, you hate whoever you see next." Well, so he pops Apollo with a golden arrow and pops Daphne with the lead arrow. Apollo sees Daphne, falls madly in love with her. Daphne sees Apollo, son of Zeus, god of the sun, and says, "Can't stand him." He makes a grab for her. She takes off. He cannot believe it. "A woman running away from me? I am Apollo. Look at my golden hair. God of the sun, think how rich I am." So he goes chasing after her, and he's arguing with her the whole time, saying, "Why are you running away? I'm the god of the sun. Now every woman wants me, and you're running away? I can't understand it. And by the way, slow down. The bramble bushes are scratching your legs. You know, don't want you to be messed up. I'll tell you what, I'll run a little slower. You run a little slower. We'll all be safe. We'll have this conversation." Okay, so that's kind of hilarious. Seeing he chases after her, and she appeals to her father to turn her into a tree to save her, right? And ever since that day, according to Ovid, and we have a little moral here, the laurel tree is sacred to Apollo, who also happens to be god of poetry. So a poet laureate wears a laurel crown. And a laurel tree in modern English is a bay leaf, right? You make spaghetti sauce. He's a bay leaf, okay. It's kind of an evergreen, but doesn't live well here because you can't stand the freezing temperature, right? So that's the laurel tree. And that's a myth, right? Now back to Aristotle. The second thing you need is character, okay? You don't have to have character. You can have puppets and you can just have ships bumping into each other, I suppose, mighty storms and nobody doing anything. But more interesting art generally involves characters who do stuff. And we know what they do because it's based on their thought. Should I investigate whether I'm sleeping with my mother? Answer, yes. That's what I call a moral choice. You could definitely say no. Whoa, don't want to go there. I'm going back to bed, says Oedipus. Plays over. Okay? So he makes a choice. Okay? And his choice shows us his character. And in Greek, that's ethos, what kind of guy he is. And with any luck, his choices form the plot of the story. So they don't have to. You can have like waves coming in, sudden bombs exploding, which have nothing to do with his choice. Should I investigate the origin of my mother? Well, three car bombs come in and blow up my building. I wouldn't say those things are related. And intellectually, I may be disgusted, but make a hell of a movie, you gotta admit. And that's what most movies are, okay? Just waiting for that. But these are the big things Aristotle liked. This is why we like Aristotle. So those are the big three elements. There's six elements. And the fourth element, we don't know what a character's thinking unless they tell us, all right? So you gotta have diction. Speech. And this speech can be more or less articulate and melodic. And the old poets would put it in verse. You know, Shakespeare wrote in verse, to be or not to be, that is the question. It's an iambic pentameter line. Okay, but that's not really important. Well, it is. It forms part of the diction, which tells us the thought, the choice of words. Modern movies seem to be... People don't go to movies to watch, to listen to the words. And it's a visual experience. But occasionally somebody, you go to a play, you have to have a lot more words because that's what carries the thing. But occasionally you get a very articulate movie. Right? It's just that sight overwhelms things. Right? So that's diction. And if it's in verse, it can be said to have a certain melody. In fact, people can sing the lines. Or they can say the lines, and you can have a nice soundtrack behind it. So any kind of play, in the larger sense of any kind of poem, in the large sense of a play or a movie or a novel, now a novel doesn't have a soundtrack, right? But you can see that a film does. You're most likely going to, and certainly a play can have musicians in the background. It adds an awful lot. Matter of fact, Shakespeare can be incredibly boring, but you put the right music behind him, and it's great. Okay, you don't have to understand anything. You know, you just get the music doing the mood. And the sixth thing, if you want to make it really good, you go for the whole spectacle, the visual. Now, this has almost nothing to do with the intellectual quality of something like Oedipus Rex, you know, where we dissect his character, look at his motivations, understand his relationship to death. But if you want to sell tickets to Rambo or, you know, whatever Star Wars, you go right for this. So here's an interesting thing. This is what makes up a poem, film, TV show, any kind of narrative art. In order of importance, intellectually, plot's the most important thing. If I'm making a movie, where am I going to put my money? You know, special effects. Okay, that's what people want. But intellectually, and this is why Aristotle is so interesting, it's the least interesting thing, because today's special, there's nothing worse than yesterday's special effects, right? People are not lining up to see Terminator 1, you know? Right? They want to see the next animation or whatever the heck's going on, right? So special effects are good for the present moment, but of course they always go out of date. I mean, you guys won't even, most kids won't watch a black and white movie. Right? They won't watch a movie with subtitles. I know the guy said, I don't pay to see no movie, I gotta read. Anyway, so but there used to be silent movies, right? And people went to them just as happily as you guys, you know, we do this. Anyway, so that's what Aristotle says in the Poetics, and that's enough. And I'm glad it was after the exam, so I wasn't tempted to have you apply that stuff to the other things. Now, the big thing today I want to do is Virgil's Aeneid. So let's get to that. And I wanted this thing on the board. So at my little experiment, throwing a little bit of the original language at you, and most of you do it very well. So, here we go. So Virgil's Aeneid is the single greatest literary written work of art in the world. That's a big statement. Big statement. And you're going to be reading it in translation. It's not going to come across to you. This is epic. What we mean by epic. You have Homer. Virgil redid Homer's epics for ancient Rome. He wrote in Latin. And the Aeneid, the name of this work, in 12 books, is the story of a guy named Aeneas, who is not a presence in our the myths we hang out with. We've heard of Abraham, we've heard of Achilles. Aeneas, you learn in school, okay? And most people don't. This is sort of separates the literary people from everybody else. So I'm not giving you the whole thing, I'm giving you one part of it. And I think you'll like it. Well, you may not like it, but I'm giving it to you anyway. Okay. Now the story of the Aeneid is the story of the founding of Rome. Rome is incredibly important because out of all of the ancient Mediterranean, of all these civilizations, round about 0 AD, Rome was in political control. They had spread out, they ruled the world. And they kept ruling the world for another 300 years. Okay. Under the Emperor Augustus, who followed his, quote, father, Caesar, the Republic fell apart and Augustus set up an empire, a dictatorship. Okay. And it was brutal, ruthless, there was genocide, there were millions killed. But we have practically no record of it, and the result was stability and peace. It's called the Pax Augustus, the Peace of Augustus. And it became highly significant in history because, of course, it's under the Pax Augustus at 0 AD that Christianity begins, right? That the world is controlled and doesn't stop the Platonic forces from, percolating, and there's slavery, and there's all sorts of bad stuff, and there's a lot of brutality out there, so there's plenty of room for improvement, right? But it was within this this system, right? So the Roman Empire had two faces: horrible brutality, slave system, everything else. Men were in control, right? But stability, peace. And Virgil's Aeneid takes both of those into account. The incredible sacrifices, the things you give up for that political stability. And he doesn't, and for a long time people said, well, he just sold out to his dictators, Virgil's a fascist. A close reading of the poem just doesn't bear this out. He even questions, was it all worth it? And he's not really sure. He maybe, perhaps, would just like to crawl back into his worshiping some local gods and wearing rags and stuff like that. There's a sort of escapist line in Virgil, too. But the story is one of the survivors of the Trojan War, named Aeneas, who is actually a brother of Paris and a brother of Hector, okay, one of the many sons of Priam, escaped when Troy fell. He got away, got out of town as the town was burning. He escaped with his wife and his young son and a bunch of followers. And just as Odysseus took 10 years to get home, that's the Odyssey, at the same time, according to Virgil, writing in about 20 BC, in other words, 600, 700 years after Homer, well after, I'm writing in Latin for Romans, not in Greek for Greeks. Writing in Latin. Virgil tells the story of this guy Aeneas and how he wandered for 10 years too, driven by his destiny, which was to found Rome, whatever that was, and he was never sure. But he read these signs, the oracles. Stuff kept pointing to him. He kept trying to found cities, and they failed. Right? And the first half of the Aeneid, there's 12 books, books 1 through 6, are his story of his wandering the Mediterranean, trying to figure out where this place Rome is that he's supposed to found. And then the second half of the poems, books 7 through 12, he finally gets to Rome, but of course there's other people there. And he tries to make friends, and it falls apart, and he has a bloody war. And at the end of the poem, he's had to kill his main rival. They've been fighting over the land and over a woman. And he wants to spare his life because he's the mighty Aeneas, and he's sort of our... He's called Pious Aeneas throughout the story. Very religious guy, very well-tempered. He's about to spare his enemy in the last line of the poem, and he notices his enemy's wearing a belt that belonged to his Aeneas' best friend who'd been killed a few days before. And he loses his grip, and he takes his knife, and he slits the guy's throat, and that's the end of the story. And the implication is, from Virgil, is watch out. You know, you turn into a monster when you start building these empires. Okay. That's a hell of a thing to say to your boss, who is Augustus Caesar, right? I mean, Virgil was very aware of the brutality and the loss, okay? One of the episodes, on the way there, Aeneas has to give up an awful lot. He may give up his soul and go straight to hell for what he did at the end there. But he gives up a lot of other stuff, leading his people to found Rome. And one of the things that happens is, in the book starts, he's in a shipwreck, and he washes ashore in modern Tunisia, in North Africa. And he's been wandering around for 10 years. And he gets there, and his mother's name is Venus, of all people, and she, you know, says hi, and he says hi. And that's book one. In Tunisia, he finds this land and it's ruled by a woman. Okay, and her name is Dido. Now, if you read Shakespeare, she shows up like every other page, but we don't tend to read Aeneas, so the Shakespeare references are lost on us. But the story of Dido is the most famous love story in ancient literature, if not in all of literature. All right, and that's what we're doing today, quickly. He washes ashore, and there's Dido, this queen. And by the way, on the way out of Troy, he'd lost his wife. She didn't keep up, so he's a widower. How convenient. Her husband has been murdered by her brother, who's a bit of a Cain figure, a bit of a rat. Okay, back in Phoenicia, modern Lebanon, where she's from. And she's made it off to North Africa for various things. And she's held out as a widow, sort of waiting for the right moment. And all the local guys, the Algerians, they're like suitors, but she's not marrying anybody. Aeneas washes ashore, and they bring him in, and they have this dinner in book one, and he starts to tell his story. Okay? Book two, he tells about the fall of Troy. And she's just rapt listening to this. And she's falling more and more in love the more he talks, okay? And it doesn't help her that Venus has thrown a snake into her bloodstream, okay? So he's got this, like, venom circulating through her, and he's telling about, and then there was this horse that came inside, and we thought it was a gift from the gods, you know? And during the night, all these Greek soldiers came out, and you get the Trojan War from the Trojan viewpoint, right? And then I had to escape. So that's book two, The Fall of Troy. That's very sad. He's got this famous line. Virgil's a stylist supreme. And Aeneas just says, Troy was. Ilium fuit. And in Latin, that meant that past tense is a definitive perfect, ends in the past. That means it was, and it's implied it is no more. My whole previous world is gone. I don't know where I'm going. Okay? Everything's lost. Everything's lost. Okay? My language, my people, everything. Okay? And we've got to start all over again. And I'm middle-aged, I'm getting old, and I'm getting really tired. Okay? But you've got to start over. Well, book three is the story of his wanderings. It's really like, just like Odysseus, he hits some of the same marvels. Whirlpools, rocks, sirens singing at him, stuff like that. By the end of book three, he finishes his story, and Dido is gaga. And that's where we come in. I gave you book four, okay? She falls madly in love with him. And what's going to happen in this is he's going to have an affair with her, and then he's going to abandon her. Because it's his destiny to found Rome, and he has to leave a lot of stuff behind. He can't help it. Okay. Now you could say he's a bit of a wreck. Okay, and a lot of people do. Right, but nonetheless, it's this horrible interplay of real life and passion with events you can't control that make this story so appealing. So let's take a quick look at the first line. So this is page 974. Well, after he leaves her, he has some funeral games in book five. He descends to hell to have a look around in book six, and then he has the wars for the rest of it. So here we are in book four. You with me on 974? The queen has been listening to this story. The queen, for her part, all that evening, ached with longing that her heart's blood fed, a wound of inward fire eating her away. The manhood of the man, his pride of birth, came home to her time and again. His looks, his words remained with her to haunt her mind, and desire for him gave her no rest. Now, if that's not incomprehensible, I don't know what is. Right? But the interesting thing about this is, if you were being educated any time between, say, 30 AD and 1925, right, all you did in school was learn Latin, the language of the Aeneid, because Rome took over the world and Latin became the universal language. You know, it is out of Latin that all the Romance languages come, French, Spanish, whatever, okay? German's different. Right? Put Germanic languages together with a Romance language like French, what do you get? Take a little German, take a little French, which is essentially the base form of Latin, and you get English. That happened in around 1400. Okay? That's where the English comes from. So we have heavy German element, and we have the Latin element in our language. Right? So you'll recognize a few of the words. But a lot of them change too. Okay. Oh boy, here we go. Well, she's fallen. Let's see what it's like for a woman to fall in love in ancient Rome. Okay. But any idea what that word is? Yeah, the queen. So that's Dido. At Regina, but the queen. Well, he's been talking, but meanwhile, the queen is. Okay, but the queen, okay, your translation says all that evening. The word just means for a long time. Now, Latin has these endings, so it doesn't come in the same order as English. So the queen, and it's a feminine ending, and this word means wounded. She's been listening and she's wounded. Something happened. I thought she was in love. I thought she was falling in love. And he says, and the first thing he tells us is she's wounded. It's pretty bad, isn't it? She's really got it. Okay? It ain't fun, you know. It goes right past the fun stage. It's big. It's the one that drives you mad. And that's what happens to her. So she's wounded. With, and this is with gravi, this means heavy, grave, okay? And this word goes with this one, with a kura, with a heavy kura. And you have to look it up. And you look up the word kura, and it says anxiety. So she's listening to him with anxiety. Care, it's pretty close to our word care. Love. That's what it's like for a woman to fall in love. Ancient Rome. Okay? It's like, man, it's bad. Okay? Really. It's an anxiety and love. It's the same word. Man, she's just bubbling. Right? Well, we haven't even got, this is just describing her. She's wounded. She's, for a long time, she's been wounded with this heavy anxiety, just listening to him, this love, this passion. And the passion hurts, right? It's so intense, right? Now you all have a great love affair sometimes, but now you know what you're in for, okay? All right? And while she's doing it, she feeds. And here, this is actually the queen feeds her, let me get the exact translation, her wound, really. Vulnus, like vulnerable. This, it's like she's been stabbed almost. With her blood, and blood in her veins. Okay? So she can feel her blood circulating, right? And it's burning. So they've got this real attachment to the, she feeds the wound, and her blood is pumping, the heart is pumping, you know, and she's getting heated up. I mean, you just feel the whole emotional thing going on, okay? Blood's circulating, she's got this, right? And carpitur. Now some of you know a little Latin already. You know the word, the phrase carpe diem, seize the day. You ever heard this? Carpe diem poem, seize the day. Ah, come on, Lucy, let's seize the day. Famous love poetry usually comes this way. We may be dead tomorrow, let's seize the day today. We all know what that means. Right? So carpe means seize. And you can reverse it. This is the reverse form, is seized by. Okay? She is seized by the blind fire. She's seized by the blind fire. Now there's an image for you. Virgil's not a joke when it comes to the poetry, because fire, of course, is usually pretty visible. Right? But this fire is burning in her blood. It's just kind of an oxymoron. And it's blind, so you can't see it. Right? And she's gripped. Right? That's pretty intense stuff. It's bad. Well, what does a girl do when she falls in love and she, you know, with a stranger? You go to your roommate, right? You get right on the cell phone, okay? You call your best friend. In ancient Rome, you go talk to your sister. Okay, I don't know what's going on today. And so she calls in her sister, Anna, and she starts talking to her, okay? And she says, you know, she'd been widowed, though. You know, she'd been married before. She's not a kid, right? And the Aeneid is a poem for adults. This is a poem you read your whole life. This is not a kid book. Okay, this is the real thing. I mean, Aeneas's cares are the cares of when you grow up and you got a family and you don't want to go to work the next day and the kids are bothering you and the wife's getting ratty and everything else and you still got to show up. Okay? It's about doing your job when things aren't going so well and you're not going anywhere either. Okay? And you just got to deal with it. All right? Well, here's Dido, you know, she's had, it's not like she's got no experience. In fact, she says, in line 32, really famous line, I recognize the signs of the old flame. It's the old flame. I felt this before. She knows she's in trouble. Your translation adds of old desire. That's not in the Latin, but it wants to make sure you get the image But you guys, having taken my first exam, know what an image is now. We know what that flame is. It ain't a flame. Right? It's our hot blood. It's our passion. Okay. And I'm going to give you a series of questions. I will give you this. So I would just take quick notes, but I'll give you this little handout I have, which I was meaning to show while I was doing this. The next thing, Anna says to Dido, she gives her a bunch of reasons why Dido should marry this guy. Sisterly advice. So the question I ask is, what are the reasons Anna gives Dido that she should remarry? She gives her a list of reasons. Okay. Why should a middle-aged woman who's finally gotten rid of her husband, and she vowed never to marry again. It wasn't like it was that great. Okay. Well, line 44, you might just want to tick these off. Well, you're alone. And this way you'll have somebody. So to avoid loneliness, that's why you get married. And then line 46, and you still don't have any children, and children are a good reason to get married. And then line 48, well, you can't live in your past. You can't live with the ghost of your dead husband. You got to move on. So avoid the ghost. Loneliness, children. Don't live in the past. That's three reasons. And line 55. Look, you're here in North Africa, modern-day Tunisia. Colonel Gaddafi in the next country over on one side, because crazy Egyptians on the other side. You need protection. And all these suitors are coming after you. You know, it's good. Somebody's going to get it, get you eventually. You need protection. And this guy is a Trojan hero with a lot of men, and he seems to know what he's doing. Okay? So he's a good guy. So there's a quick bunch of reactions. Joy? Ah, yeah. Well, you know me, I kind of censor my whole presentation here. Yeah, there are other reasons. Okay. Yeah. Joie. A very French notion. Okay. Okay. Joy. Yeah, you got me. I'm sure there's others. So I asked the question, what are the reasons? And I give you a few suggestions. But the true detective sees them. Okay. Now, what's happening is this is a tragic love affair, and the next question I have to ask are, what are the signs that Dido is going insane right away from her love? I mean, she's gripped. And if you turn to line 115, well, let's look at line 93. She starts visiting all the temple shrines. How do you get this guy? This guy's been wandering around. He doesn't look like he's staying here. What am I falling in love with this guy for? Besides that, everything he told me, if you were paying attention, the gods hate him. They hate him. His men are dying. The ships are wrecking. Everything's bad. This guy's, you know, I mean, he's like, doesn't seem to be ill. And he's got that kind of glassy look in his eyes. And they call him Pius Aeneas. Right? He's a man on a mission. Do I really want to marry him? Right? Well, she starts going around to the shrines, sort of looking for signs, taking vows, looking at the you know, tipping out wine, you know, doing those sort of things Romans did to predict the future. So just tick off like 93. Okay, she attends the sacrifices. Then at line 95, she wanders around the city. Unlucky Dido, burning in her madness, roamed through all the city like a doe hit by an arrow. And you get this long simile. She, you know, she's been wounded by the arrow, and she's just wandering around. She starts to have more banquets. Ah, get him back in. We had such a wonderful night. What a first date. Let's try and do it again. This is a terrible sign. Okay, trying to recreate that wonderful first night. You know, can't do it. And line 115, you know, the Romans, they ate on these couches, right? She goes, and when she's all alone, she goes back to the banquet hall to remember the good old times. She starts touching the bed, the couch where he lay. Okay? I mean, she's really got it bad. It's like going on the internet finding out everything about him, you know, tracking him, right? One 121, all her work stops. She'd been building a big new city. Line 121, towers half built, rose no further. She couldn't work. She can't do her homework. She can't attend class. A little bigger, right? She can't get up and do what she's supposed to do. She's obsessed. Right? Well, Venus and Juno hates Aeneas. She's the queen of the gods. She's hounding him, okay? Just like she hounded all the Trojans when she was called Hera back in Greek. But Venus, the goddess of love, is Aeneas' mother. And Juno offers the deal to Venus. She wants to keep Aeneas in Tunisia, which is where later, in Roman times, it was called Carthage. Remember Carthage? Maybe a little bit of history. The Romans fought the Carthaginians in the Punic Wars, and the big Carthage general. In other words, Rome fought North Africa for control of the Mediterranean. This is around 100 BC, 200 BC. A series of wars called the Punic Wars. And the big Carthaginian general used elephants, came through the Alps, almost defeated Rome. Remember, who was he? Hannibal. Okay. So in Virgil's own day, there will be the Carthaginian Wars. Back in around when he sets this thing in the past, you see, he's creating this story of ancient enmity between Rome and North Africa, Dido's time. So her land will eventually become Carthage, right? And it's a matter of Juno, who's in favor of the Carthaginians with their elephants and Hannibal, you know, versus the Roman deity, Venus, who, by the way, Julius Caesar claimed to be descended from. Okay? Julius Caesar claimed to be. So Aeneas is kind of on the Venus, the love side. And Juno is the bitch, you know, wife of Zeus. Okay? All right, just put it bluntly. All right? Well, Juno wants Aeneas to stay in Carthage because she knows this guy's hot, you know? So she said, well, arrange a marriage. And Juno just happens to be the goddess of childbirth, and that her plan is at 165. And Venus at 178, she agrees to this. She came from the island of Cythera, so they call her Cytherea. Then Cytherea, not disinclined, nodded to Juno's plea and smiled at the stratagem now given away. Venus says, sure, let him marry my boy Aeneas. Let them sleep together. He's a man. I'm Venus. I don't expect him to be, you know. I know Dido's going to get kind of worked up, right? Well, they go on a hunt. Line 210, Aeneas is looking good. He's looking fabulous. He looks like Apollo. Remember, Apollo's always trouble. Dido should have known. Never mess with a guy who looks like Apollo. King's son, right? It starts to rain, line 221. Thunder's rolling in. Dido's with her hunters over there. They're looking for lions and bears. And Aeneas is with his men, and it's thunder, and it's pouring rain because Juno, besides being goddess of childbirth, is goddess of the air. She runs those rainstorms. So she's bringing down this rainstorm, and just what she wants happen. And Dido ducks into a cave. Happens to be no followers. She's sort of been on her own for a second, and Aeneas ducks into the same cave, and by unbelievable coincidence, he's left all his people behind. So they're in this cave in this wild rainstorm, alone. Line 226, now to the selfsame cave came Dido and the captain of the Trojans, just as Juno planned. Primal earth, the earth shaked. Anybody read Hemingway? You don't remember in, what is it, For Whom the Bell Tolls? Robert Jordan gets in bed with the Maria during the Spanish Civil War, you know, and get in the same sleeping bag, and he goes, did you feel the earth move? Yes, Robert, I heard, felt the earth move. Was it that good? It was that good. The earth moved. Well, here the earth moved. in case you don't know what's going on, right? primal earth herself, a nuptial Juno, opened the ritual. Torches of lightning blazed. High heaven became witness to the marriage. And nymphs cried out wild hymns from the mountaintop. They ain't married. They're just in a cave. But they're doing things that look like marriage, right? That day was the first cause of death and first of sorrow. Dido had no further qualms as to impressions given and said abroad. She thought no longer of a secret love. She's not going around to all the shrine.